Okay, here we go. The period that I want to talk about now is the late medieval period, moving into the modern period. The first thing I want to talk about is Kabbalah. Oh, Kabbalah. Just after Rashbi's Keva, right? So we know all about Kabbalah. So while the Torah tells us what God wants, Kabbalah tries to tell us who God is, right? What is God's essence? Now, already in Tanakh, we have the Ma'aseh Merkava in Sefer Yechezkel, some sort of vision of God on a crazy chariot with different animals. And like, obviously, it's a sort of mystical thing. And the Gemara tells us of four great rabbis that went to study Kabbalah. That's good. Nichnas LaPardes. What were the names of the rabbis?
Rabbi
Akiva. Acher. Good. Who else? Ben. Azai and Ben Zoma. Now, what happened to these four?
Yeah, them went off the dare slash crazy.
Okay, so Rabbi Akiva comes out. B'shalom. Hey, comes in B'shalom, walks out B'shalom. And the others, Ben Azai went mad. Ben Zoma dropped dead. And Elisha ben Avua, famously known as Acher, went off the derech. Okay, so this idea of mystical teaching is definitely in the Gemara. The Ramban. Okay, now we have Artsko Rambans, which doesn't really help because whenever this part, they don't translate it. But the Ramban says, Ba'al pi derech ha'emes, right? If you want to know, like the emes, he's talking Kabbalistic stuff. So then he goes and talks Kabbalah. Okay, I was very disappointed in the art scroll that it says, this is mystical, we're not explaining it. Okay, fine. But what is the book that is the most famous when we talk about Kabbalah?
Tanya.
Zohar.
Not the Tanya.
Zohar.
The Zohar.
Well,
the Zohar.
Yes.
Zohar is the most famous work. When did we get it into our hands?
When you're Yeshua and Baruch Hai died.
So that's what you would think, but it's not even close. Okay, it was revealed in the 13th century.
I don't know.
Okay? Over 1,000 years after Shem Vayochai. Okay? By a Rav Moshe de Leon. He claimed that it was the mystical writings of Rav Shem Vayochai. Today, all academics, all Jewish academics, or academics of, you know, Jewish studies, will tell you it was written by Moshe de Leon. What's the best proof? His wife, after he died, said, I saw him working on it. Okay? And on the opposite side of the spectrum, pretty much all rabbis, if you take a poll of rabbis here in the yeshiva, they will tell you who wrote the Zohar? Shem Yochai. I'm sure that's what they told you when you were Meiron, right? Shem Yochai wrote the Zohar. Now, famously, one great rabbi, Rabbi Yaakov Emden, said, no, he didn't. But he's like a minority. There are others that say it as well. And there certainly are many that say you're not an apikoros for saying that Rav Shem Vayochai did not write the Zohar. My view on this is, like, okay, parts of it for sure weren't written by him. Why? Because parts of it, according to Amorayim, Rav Shem Vayochai was a Tana. So there's parts that it's clearly cannot have been written by him unless you want to start saying Ropa Ruha Kodesh, that Abayin and Rav are going to have machlokas. It's really, really weird. Okay? But rather, to me, it's irrelevant. If it was Moshe de Leon, or if it was Rav Shem Yochai, Moshe de Leon is a Rishon. No one's sitting there, oh, I'm not going to learn the Rambam. He's only a Rishon. I'm not going to learn the Ramban. He's only a Rishon. Rav Moshe de Leon is a Rishon. His writings were taken seriously. Many commentaries were written on it. Lots of people study it. And therefore, who cares who the author is? The material is taken seriously and is studied. It would be like, you know, we know Rabbi Yehuda Levi wrote the Kuzari, and he writes an introduction, oh, I found the diary of the Melech HaKuzar, why he converted, conversations between him and this rabbi from like the 8th century in White Russia. Okay, most people understand that wasn't written, it wasn't his real diary. And no one's upset about it. Okay, so it's not the diary, it's literary forgery, but it's Rabbi Yehuda Levi wrote it. He's a Rishon. He has his interesting ideas, and people study it. So I would say the same thing.
But there's, I feel like, a difference by the Zohar and the story.
Why?
Because I feel like by the Zohar, but they pass an halacha off of it.
So
if you're saying
we pass an halacha from the Rambam, he's a Rishon.
But Rambam, where does Rambam get it from? The Torah or Gemara?
I don't know. He gets it. We look for his sources.
Did they quote
we look for his sources. We look for his sources, but I don't know. I'm thinking, like, I find it interesting. Did I ever speak to you about, like, why I think the Maharal didn't create the Golem?
Yeah.
Okay. So I think, like, here are two people. There was great rabbis, and I think they're most well known for things they didn't do. The Maharal is a prolific author. What's he most known for? The Golem that he didn't correct, didn't create. Rav Shimon Yochai is a Tana. Stam Rabbi Shimon in the Mishnah is Rav Shimon Yochai. Every time I say Rav Shimon, it's Rav Shimon Yochai. There's Gemaras of Rav Shimon Yochai, and he went into the cave, and he learned that. There's so many things about Rav Shimon Yochai. What's he most known for? Possibly the one thing that he didn't do. Like, why do we have to attribute something to him and make that the main thing when it could very well be that he didn't do it? But even if he didn't do it, so what? It's still a work of a Rishon, and it's taken seriously. So you're right. You're saying that maybe today, if it would just be a Rishon, we wouldn't be saying Brich Shemei, we take out the Torah, and we wouldn't be saying all these other Zoharistic things, Tfilot, because we don't really have other Tfilot. Maybe yes, maybe no. I hear it, but I just think, like, it is studied. Great Rabbanim have been discussing this for centuries, since the 13th century. I find it interesting. The Ramban, who lived just a little before him, never mentions the Zohar. Why not? Because it was no Zohar.
So where does Kabbalah come from, except from the Zohar?
So there were mystical teachings. That's what I'm saying. We already talk about mystical teachings.
But they said, like, okay? I thought he was saying, like, he started the entire idea of
Kabbalah. No, no. As I said, the Gemara talks about they went into paradise.
Oh, right? Okay.
There were mystical teachings. The Ramban talks about Derech HaEmet. But the book, the Zohar, might be a literary forgery. But I say, so what? Even if it was literary, it was written by a Rishon. It's no different than Rav Yehuda Levi saying, I found the diary of the Melech of the Khazars. You know, the book itself is what's important, not who wrote it. And if so many people have been studying it and gleaned ideas from it, so then, great. It's a safer to be learned. Whether or not Rav Shimon Yochai wrote it. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. Maybe he was followed up by students and grand students and great grand students quoting Amoraim. Okay? Or at least maybe part of it is, maybe it was, maybe, I don't know. But like I said, I asked a rabbi academic who dominates in my shul. I said, do most academics feel that Rav Shimon Yochai didn't write this? He goes, all academics feel that way. He goes, you won't find any serious academic that'll tell you it was written by Shimon Yochai. There's like too much incongruous stuff for it to be written by Rav Shimon Yochai. But like I said, so what? And then later on, the Arizal. Okay? What does Ari stand for?
His name, Rav Ashkenazi.
Adonenu Rabbeinu Yitzchak. What's his last name?
Ashkenazi.
No, Luria.
Oh, Luria.
Oh, okay? Yeah, he was Ashkenazi. Okay? So the Ari took this to a new level and became the father of contemporary Kabbalah. And that's known as Lurianic Kabbalah. And that's the generally accepted Kabbalah most people learn. And it's also generally accepted that you shouldn't really dabble in that until at least you're 40. Every so often you have some Shana Aleph guy that says, oh, I want to learn Kabbalah. Okay, that's ridiculous. But okay.
Sephardi is born that way. That's what I said, something close to Sephardi once about that. It's okay. Like we were born reading Kabbalah.
Okay, maybe. But you have guys in yeshiva that don't know, you know, basic Chumash and Rashi, and they want to learn Kabbalah. Okay, fine. Next. Gzeirat Tach B'Tach. Tach B'Tach. 1648 to 1649, and this is referred to as the Khmelnytsky massacres. Okay, this was the Holocaust before the Holocaust, and there was a guy, Bogdan Khmelnytsky. He led a Ukrainian rebellion against the Polish rule in his country. Okay, today, if you go to Ukraine, there are statues in his honor. There are streets named after him. He's considered a hero for a successful revolt. Now, since many Jews worked for Polish noblemen who owned Ukrainian land, also Jews owned taverns, and Polish and Ukrainians, they both like to drink a lot, so their money was being, like, basically deposited into the tavern instead of to their bank. There was a lot of animosity towards the Jews who were, as I said, working for the landowners, collecting taxes, selling them liquor. Jews became the object of hatred. And like Hitler, not just those Jews, all Jews. In a time when world Jewry numbered about 1.5 million people, 1.5 million Jews, 100,000 Jews were killed between the year 1648 and 1649, over a year and a half. 100,000 Jews were killed. No automatic weapons, no gas chambers. This is the same number of Jews that were killed in the 200 years of the Crusades. And now, in just a year and a half, you had 100,000 Jews killed. There's memoir. Yeah?
How many Jews were in Poland?
I don't know, but a large percentage of them were killed. Okay? The memoir literature talks about soldiers peeling their fingers off the sword because they've been clenching it and killing so many people. And they had the most barbaric torture. Sounds like October 7th. They burned people alive. They cut arms and feet off of people and threw them in the street to be trampled upon by horses. They cut open pregnant women and threw the fetus at their face. They cut open a pregnant woman after cutting off her arms and put a cat on top of her stomach to start eating away at the fetus without her having any way of getting rid of the cat. It was disgusting. It was barbaric. And unfortunately, it hasn't stopped in modern times. This time period, 1648 to 1649, was a turning point. The Tosus Yantif, Tosus Yantif composed a Mishaberach that isn't found in some of the Siddurim, a Mishaberach for all the people who don't talk during davening. He attributed this to the widespread meaning of talking during davening. This is what, you know, Jews always look inward. What did we do to deserve this? This was his suggestion. And there is a Mishaberach in many Siddurim for all the people who don't talk during davening. Okay. Now, this is sort of related. The next section is Shabtai Tzvi. Shabtai Tzvi is a Turkish Jew. His years are 1628 to 1676. Okay? He does not live a long time. After the debacle of Khmelnytsky massacres, the Jews are looking for redemption, right? Jews have been brought up to say there's going to be a darkness before the dawn. There's going to be Mechama Gog Magog before Mashiach's going to come. We have never suffered like we did before. Obviously, this is Gog Magog. Obviously, Mashiach's on his way. And now appears a guy named Shabtai Tzvi, and he proclaims that he is Mashiach. Okay? He has a spokesperson. What's his name? Nathan of Gaza. Okay? Nathan of Gaza.
He's from Gaza?
He's from Gaza. Okay? Jews used to live in Gaza. Okay? Nathan of Gaza. Nathan of Gaza is his publicist. And by the year 1665, half of world Jewry is convinced that Shabtai Tzvi is Mashiach. Not like a few people here and there. 50% of world Jewry was convinced that he is Mashiach and he would soon liberate Israel from foreign rule. In this century, 17th century, who is in charge of Palestine?
Ottomans.
Okay. He was a mystic. He learned Kabbalah. And he was probably, according to later historians, a manic depressive. Okay? This is how the today historians view him, because he had tremendous mood swings, almost like different personalities, and that led to his aura. Wow, like he'd be very super energetic and charismatic, and then all of a sudden he'd get into like this funk and depressed, and people just viewed it as, okay, he's communing with
he's
God,
holy.
And it's holy. He did a lot of weird things. He married a Sefer Torah, okay, with chuppah, right? I'm not sure how he consummated the marriage, but that's a separate issue. And he, you know, he, but this is what he did. Now, his reputation begins to grow, the Sultan calls him in. In the beginning, the Sultan was like, okay with this. It's good for tourism. People keep coming, flocking to Turkey to visit this guy. It's like having the Olympics, you know, more and more tourists coming in. But then when someone said, you know what he's supposed to do? He's supposed to liberate Palestine from Ottoman rule. He goes, oh, no one explained that part to me. So he calls him, and the Sultan gives him a choice. Either convert to Islam or die. And Shabtai Tzvi said, all right, I'll go on behind door number two. Oh, no, no, take it back, door number one, convert. And he converts. And Am Yisrael is devastated. They're devastated. You know, first they dealt with the Chalmnitsky massacres, and now when they got so psyched up that Mashiach was coming, this was another severe blow to the Jewish world. But not the fear, not the Nafgaza was there to explain everything. And he said it's all part of the plan. Because if you know Kabbalah, you know that the job is to metaken all the klipas. And who's got more klipas than anyone else? The Muslims. So he had to infiltrate into Islamic culture and society to start fixing from all the way on the bottom. Okay, go to the lowest level. And as weird as that sounds, thousands of Jews continue to believe in Shabtai Tzvi. Okay?
What do you do as a Muslim?
He's just a practicing Muslim under the careful eye of the Sultan. And people still believed in him. Now, obviously, he's incognito. It's all part of the plan. So obviously, he died. But no, guess what? Even after he died, people continued to believe for generations, possibly centuries, that Shabtai Tzvi is Messiah. How? Not really sure how that works. But even after his death, people believed, and people were accused of becoming Sabbateans. Rav Yaakov Emden, who I mentioned before, accused the Gadol Ador of his time, Rav Yonatan Eipshus, of being a secret believer in Shabtai Tzvi. This is after Shabtai Tzvi died.
I mean, like, once you have a practical example, then it's like, I guess.
Right. So he wrote Kamiyas, and supposedly Rav Yaakov Emden was shown it, and he said, oh, it's all these, like, hints towards Shabtai Tzvi. And he accused him of being a secret follower of Shabtai Tzvi. Like, it's a crazy thing to think about.
Not really, though. No, not in our days.
I mean, think about it in our days. Okay? Imagine if, I don't know, let's use rabbis from Israel of last generation. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach get up there and accuse Rabbi Yashiv of being follower of Shabtai Tzvi. That's what it was like. You had these two big Gedolim, and obviously it split the Torah world. Okay? You had these two big Gedolim, and one's calling the other one a follower of Shabtai Tzvi.
How did he respond?
He ignored, he said no, but there's all sorts of stuff about this. And if you think that it's like so far-fetched and crazy, this is a verifiable fact. Rav Yonatan Eipshus, the Gadol Ador, his son is without a doubt, was without a doubt, a follower of Shabtai Tzvi. There's nothing to argue about. So it wasn't like Rav Yaakov and then had nothing to go on. So all of a sudden I said, oh, you're probably a follower of Jesus, Jews for Jesus. Like, where'd you get that from? Okay? If your kid was a follower, be a little bit more home. Maybe there's something there. There's a lot of stuff written on this. One of my professors in graduate school has published a lot on it, a person named Dr. Schneer Lyman. And I've heard several things by him about this. It's a very interesting topic. Another one of my professors, Dr. David Berger, he had said, he was then teaching in Queens College, he said, I want to get this room. I'm having this panel discussion, like something like the Emden-Eipshitz controversy. And Queens God, they said, like, when is this from? He goes, oh, it's like from the 18th century. These two 17th century rabbis, this dispute. And they said, all right, we'll give you this little room. Like, they feel like, how many people are going to come to this, like, archaic thing? He said, no, I need a bigger auditorium. I go, nah. And, like, it was, like, standing around, there's people that, like, it was so many people came. Like, they couldn't understand why would this, something that they, the Goyim, had never heard of, attract, because it's really juicy. There's really a lot on this. All right. You know, there was even one thing I remember reading in Tradition magazine. I forgot right now, Dr. Lyman wrote this, where some guy gave a bracha that the kid, the new baby at like a bris, should turn out to be the opposite of, you know, whatever, like Rav Yonatan Eipshitz. And then whatever, he turned out to be like a Sabbatean. I don't know, like all sorts of weird stuff, you know, like assuming that the bracha worked. But, you know, okay.
Didn't they believe in him because they thought he did like miracles and stuff?
Did they believe in who? Shabbat Tzvi?
Yeah.
No, he didn't do any miracles. No miracles.
Just showed up one day and was like, hey.
Yeah, he was charismatic. And he was into Kabbalah, and he went to Kabbalah. And one of the reasons why people then said stay away from Kabbalah was because of this. Next, last topic, the Haskalah. The Age of Enlightenment swept through Europe with the pursuit of happiness and liberalism and reason and separation of church and state, and so too amongst the Jews. And amongst the Jews, the Enlightenment is called Haskalah, from the word Seichel, you know, reason. Okay, rabbinic Judaism was viewed as superstitious and intolerant, and therefore they wanted freedom of thought and rationalism and Western values over Torah values. And this was the first time en masse that Jews left the fold without leaving the religion. You had before Jews being baptized and leaving the religion, but now Jews just said, we're maintaining our Jewishness, but we're going to be rational and we're going to do things our way. So there were three basic approaches. This I saw in one of the many books written by Rabbi Jonathan Sacks. Three basic approaches to dealing with Haskalah. First, the altar of Navarik. Rabbi Yosef Yosel Horowitz opened up yeshivas all over Europe, opened up over 50 yeshivas, and he sent out students to kidnap Jews and bring them to yeshiva. Okay, if you saw like a Jew on the train on his way off to university because he wanted to go and like see what the big world is about, he wanted to be intellectually stimulated, so he sent people on the train to like get into conversation with them and say, you're looking for intellectual stimulation? There's nothing more stimulating than learning Talmud. Come to the yeshiva. Come learn with us. He goes, where do you have a yeshiva? Just happens to be next stop. So wherever it was, like there was a yeshiva. So they had like 50 yeshivas all over, all along the train line, and they'd like bring people up. Come learn. Eshet Torah did similar stuff. They had Rav Meir Shuster, like, you know, walking up to the Kotel and seeing a guy with a backpack and saying, hey, come learn in yeshiva a little bit. You're here anyway. So this is what they would do. And they, like, try to get people. They were on their way off the derech to get them into yeshiva.
Tap on the shoulder, right?
Yep. Second idea, Rav Shin Shaval Hirsch, who lived from 1808, I think, to 1888, he comes to Frankfurt. He's the only frum Jew in Frankfurt when he gets there. And by the time he dies, he leaves thousands. Okay? He gathered all these Jews that lived in little shtetls that didn't really know that much. They're pretty much ignorant. Even the rabbis were pretty ignorant. If you watch Fiddler on the Roof, you see like they ask the rabbi and he goes, he's right. He's right. How can they both be right? Oh, you're right too. Right? So the rabbis were not necessarily holding. And he gathered people to the big city. So a powerful Rav with a good educational system would combat Haskalah instead of them being sitting ducks. Okay, also part of Fiddler on the Roof. You have this one guy who's into Haskalah and he leads one of the daughters of Tevye astray, you know. But this is the idea. Come to a big city, you know, and there'll be strength in numbers, this rabbi and education, and second approach. Third approach, and probably the most important for us today, was the approach of the Chassam Sofer. Chassam Sofer went from Germany to Hungary, and he witnessed these enlightened rabbis, okay, which then would become Reform rabbis, polluting the minds of innocent congregants who didn't know that these new innovations were actually heretical. Right? If today the rabbi would say to you, no tachlin, we'd all say, fine. Like, we don't care. We don't ask yes. Why. We just say, good. Right? So the rabbis were saying, all right, we're going to move the bima from the front of the shul to the middle of the shul. It's better acoustics. People can hear it. They say, great. They let's, instead of getting married outside, it's too cold, let's get married inside. Okay. So they just start making, and then they start doing things that are actually totally against halacha, but you don't know, you trust your rabbi. So what did Chassam Sofer say? There is nothing, no innovations. Chadash asur min haTorah. Okay, there is a Mishnah that says this, is referring to the new grains, right? Chadash, the new grains that we have to wait until we bring the carbon omer, you know, before we can have the new grains. Chadash is an Isra Doraisa. So they became their banner. Chadash, any innovation, is an Isra Doraisa. So therefore, you'll say, we cannot move the bima to the middle. We cannot get married outside. Even though, even things that are not necessarily anything problematic halachically, because it's a slippery slope. You never know when your rabbi is going to slip something in there that's actually anti-halacha. So everything is usur. We have to dress the way they did in the 19th century, continue to dress, even though the Jews in the 19th century were dressing like goyim of the 19th century. But we don't do anything new, because you never know where that could lead. And in my opinion, that's exactly what we have today in the Haredi community in Israel. The Haredim came and they were so intent on trying to rebuild life in Europe. So all the yeshivas in Israel, they have the names of the European yeshivas. I'm learning Mir, I'm learning Lakewood. No, Lakewood's a bad example. Mir, Panovich, you know. So these were like, we're trying to they're trying to continue the legacy of what was before. We don't do anything new. We want to live our life the way that they did before. Chadash asur min haTorah. Okay, this is like the main goal. Beware of the slippery slope. And that was a third, and till today, this is the way of dealing with Haskalah. And that's why today, if you want to go into the army, because you'll hear open-minded people speaking, it might influence you. So we'd rather remain in our ghettos and not possibly be influenced, because who knows where it could lead. Okay, we'll stop over here.